Senator Elam says we're being ridiculed in Europe. That doesn't bother me a bit. If those countries over there would pay us what they owe us, we could retire the national debt. On the university level, our commitment to the independence of the academic community means that we can take great pride in the maturity with which, 2 years ago, both the Rutgers administration and Governor Hughes of New Jersey handled the matter of Eugene Genovese. Professor Genovese, as you may recall, became a center of national controversy because of his avowal at a teach-in of sympathy for the Viet Cong cause. When the Rutgers Board of Governors declined to interfere and were supported in this stand by the governor's Republican opponent pitched most of his campaign on this one demagogic issue. And it is a tribute to the sophistication of the New Jersey electorate that all the Republican candidate won for himself was a place in oblivion. By way of contrast, the trustees of the University of Illinois deserve, I am afraid, severe censure for the way they have thus far handled the question whether the local chapter of the Du Bois Club should be deemed to be a recognized student group. Just what the trustees have decided, except that they don't like the Du Bois Club, is not easy to determine, perhaps because their successive communiques are less than clear. But it may be fair to conjecture that the trustees have reached at least one, and perhaps both, of the following conclusions. One, that they are persuaded, the trustees, by accusations not tested in accordance with the prescriptions of due process of law, that the applicant group, or a national group, by which it is said to be controlled, is, quote, subversive, quote, seditious, or, quote, un-American, within the meaning of the almost certainly unconstitutional Claybaugh Act. Two, an alternate construction, that they, the trustees, should be guided in matters of this kind by the Illinois Senate. Whether the trustees regard themselves as standing on one or both of these grounds, or on some other ground as yet undisclosed, they would do well, I suggest, to rethink the issue in the light of events which shook this university more than half a century ago. I'm thinking of what happened in 1914, when a small clique within the Board of Trustees attempted to undermine the academic authority of that redoubtable figure, President Edmund James. Many issues were in play, but not least among them was a proposal that the trustees share what had theretofore been the president's exclusive responsibility for proposing faculty appointments and promotions for board action. Had it been adopted, this proposal, in combination with certain other reforms which the activist trustees had in mind, would in all likelihood have reduced the president to a cipher. And it was probably so intended. At a minimum, it would have posed the gravest of threats to the academic integrity of this university. Responding with vigor, President James convened a meeting of the Faculty Senate and put to his colleagues, by secret ballot, the question whether they had confidence in his 10 years of leadership of the university. The Senate, acting with the same perception and decisiveness which have, as I see it, characterized their approach to the present episode, supported the president by a vote of 188-4. In the face of this extraordinary testament to the unity of the faculty and administration, news of which was quickly and widely disseminated, the challenge to the university melted away. The terms in which the Chicago Tribune, yes, the Tribune, summed up the matter editorially, have, I suggest, relevant application today. If we know the conditions of our own well-being, said the Tribune, if we understand and honor the principles and ideals of our country, we shall guard jealously the freedom of our schools, and we shall punish swiftly and certainly any man or interest which attacks that freedom. Some may feel that it is a discourtesy for me to stand here and speak in critical terms of the proprietors of my host institution. I have thought about this, and I have concluded that the real discourtesy would have been to remain silent, for this would have betokened an assumption that this lectern was set here by the trustees and by the people of Illinois, and I bidden to come to it for triviality's sake. The case is made difficult, wrote Justice Jackson in Barnett, not because the principles of decision are obscure, but because the flag involved is our own. The justice might have added that in 1943, the flag salute case seemed even more difficult because we were at war. And surely the fact that we are again at war is what adds a special dimension of apparent difficulty to problems of the sort represented by the Genovese and Du Bois episodes. Perhaps indeed that difficulty is compounded by the fact that our combat commitment today has not evoked the full citizen support which prevailed in World War II, and even by and large during the Korean War. And the center of articulate civilian skepticism of the view that we have blundered into a major war through what Arthur Schlesinger calls the politics of inadvertence seems to be the academic community. Perhaps this is not entirely a measure of the oft-asserted fuzziness of those engaged in learning and teaching. Perhaps this is in some degree a measure of the capacity of members of a free community for independent thought about great issues, and also a measure of their sense of a shared responsibility to think out loud. There is, of course, nothing new in the fact that dissent may prove deeply disturbing to confident majorities, let alone to querulous and uncertain ones. But the very function of dissent is to challenge, and perhaps correct, prevailing presuppositions. As Justice Jackson observed, freedom to differ is not limited to things that do not matter much. That would be a mere shadow of freedom. The test of its substance is the right to differ as to things that touch the heart of the existing order. Members of the academic community have two roles to play. They must act in the great, the so-called real world. Thus, by way of example, we are all lastingly indebted to the little group of college students who in Greensboro in the spring of 1960 took it in their heads to sit in at a segregated lunch counter. And they must generate the ideas which make the great world continue to turn. 2 years ago last March, in company with scores of thousands of others, many of whom had walked all the way from Selma, I stood in front of the Capitol at Montgomery, the birthplace of the Confederacy, and listened to Martin Luther King. Next to me stood Van Woodward. Midway in his speech, Dr. King talked of the evils of segregation. To make his point, he quoted a paragraph from Woodward's remarkable book, The Strange Career of Jim Crow. And as I watched the crowd's rapt attention to the words of one who was, though they knew it not, one of their own number, I for the first time understood the words of Holmes. The man of action has the present, but the thinker controls the future. His is the most subtle, the most far-reaching power. His ambition is the vastest, as it is the most ideal.